Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
This is Superlative, a podcast about watches, the people behind them, and the worlds that inspire them. Spending time with the Blog to Watch community and the stories we discover. Let's get started. Hey everyone, Ariel Adams with the Superlative Podcast. My guest today is Mr. Paolo Morai. He is the CEO of the Timex Group Luxury Division. Paolo, welcome.
Welcome, and thanks for asking me to join this conference.
You know, one of the things I'm so excited about before we speak, and we actually haven't had like an in-depth meeting together before, is the fact that you are one of the true veterans of this space. You know, you've been in your position for, I think it was like 17 or 18 years now. You know, you've seen a lot, and this is a space that has a lot of managers that come and go. Do you feel that you've seen the watch industry evolve since you've been in it for as long as you have?
Well, I think that my reply is definitely yes. I've been, as you mentioned, 16 years in this position, but prior to my position in Timex Group, I also worked for Swatch Group back 25 years ago. So I can say I'm quite a veteran of the watch industry for sure. And as you can imagine, since the late 80s, early 90s, things have dramatically changed. So at that time, the complete evolution of Swatch Group, which I was part of, was very significant. And today, a lot of other trends are completely changing the watch industry, including the smartwatch phenomenon.
Do you find it kind of reassuring? I know I do, and I've had this conversation with many people, that today in 2021, even though we live in a world of lots of unpredictability, we seem to feel that luxury watches aren't going anywhere. What they look like, how they're sold, who buys them, all that might change. But the luxury watch as a product has remained stubbornly enduring. You know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. I mean, things keep changing, but in a changement period, you have to find different ways. So as you mentioned, distribution might be changing, consumer habit might be changing, new consumer coming to the market. So you have to really carefully read the market and be prepared for, let's say, once we will say for the years to come, now I say for the months to come, because things are keep changing so fast that whatever strategy you set up, it will need to be adapted 6 months later. So it really is to focus on the market, on the consumer, end consumer, of course, and then find a way to reach the end consumer, which might not be the same way that we used in the past, but there is a way to remain. Just to make a small comparison to make everybody understand, today we are in the world of computer and everything is typing on a computer, but writing instruments are still there. So, I mean, everybody still buy writing instruments because it is still a kind of status symbol if you are part of a certain world. So watches, luxury watches will definitely remain.
Yeah, and I was having lunch today with someone who actually pulled out their Mont Blanc pen. They had a fountain pen from Mont Blanc, and they said they didn't use it very often. This was a gentleman from Spain, and so you're right. There are a lot of products like watches that remain. But, you know, pens aren't universal around the world, but watches seem to be universal. Like, if you get to a point where you're cultured enough and you have enough disposable income, doesn't matter where you are in the world, you find a way to watches, don't you?
No, absolutely. And as you mentioned, not necessarily something that you use every day, but you want to have it because you know that one day you will use it. And then do not forget that while women can have different accessories for themselves, we as men, we don't have so many. So especially on the men's side, the watch will definitely remain as a watch because it's a kind of one of the few things that we can really wear. And for women, it is becoming more and more an accessory. So not just a timekeeping function, but as an accessory, which has to fit with your way of dressing or with your mood of the day. So it is an evolution, yeah, but something that remains.
And these are simple things, but they create lots and lots of demand. I'm going to give a little bit of context and discuss Timex, but I would love for you to explain the Timex luxury division. For everyone that doesn't already know, Timex is an American company. It's one of the few American watch companies that's still around. It's a big company. There are some competitors out there, but it's one of the bigger ones. But even though they're an American company, you know, watchmaking is something that really has to have some type of foot or arm in Switzerland, no matter what you do. And Timex makes a lot of different types of products at different price ranges. And there is a team of people based in Switzerland as well as Italy who produce and design sometimes higher-end watches, a lot of watches for fashion brands and things like that, really high-end labels that you know, it really matters what their products are. And that's sort of what I understand the Timex Group Luxury Division is. But I'd love for you to introduce it, explain when it started and why, and generally what your team does.
Okay, good. Well, as you mentioned, we are part of Timex Group, which basically started 170 years ago in the United States, and the brand, Timex brand, is still there, being definitely the market leader in the U.S. mass market and well-distributed all over the world. Back in 2004, there was an opportunity for Timex Group to expand beyond the Timex brand and other, let's say, fashion license to enter in the more, let's say, upscale luxury world of watches, creating a company based in Switzerland to run operation for Swiss-made watches. And so in the end of 2004, beginning 2005, they made an acquisition of an existing company, which was at that time owned by Versace, and which was the company which used to manufacture and distribute the Versace watches and jewels.
Was that Veritime?
Yeah, the company at that time was called Veritime, which was a mix of Versace and Timex.
Okay,
That's why the Veritime is the name. And since 2005, we started running the operation, of course, at the beginning just for Versace, but then expanded to other, say, luxury fashion brands, particularly Italian brands, for some reasons. First, because we are based in Lugano, so which is very close to the Italian border, which makes us an easy access for this maison to meet, discuss, propose, evaluate, design, etc. Second, because we have our own design center based in Milano, which is, again, it's not only a question of accessibility, but also of understanding. So to interpret it, the brand DNA is for us very important because, as you know, the space on a watch is very limited. And if you are not capable to well interpret the brand DNA and the distinctive traits, you can create a watch. But then without putting the name on the dial, will be very difficult for the end consumer to distinguish. So in our case, we are definitely very strong in creating these very distinctive pieces.
I got to sort of bring a little bit more context into this because I think it's so important to discuss why, in the first place, these really important fashion houses would want to work with a third-party company to do all of this watchmaking stuff for them. Because as you said, I think it's important to unpack this. Your team works with, let's just say, Versace, because it's one of the most important ones, and you design watches that fit with their brand, and then you also produce them. You don't just take their designs. You create a watch that is meant to fit within the Versace DNA universe, and then you, of course, make it. And those are two completely different things.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, when we talk about inspiration, these always come from the Maison. So Donatella and her team of designers are always the inspiration for any watch. So they give us some inspiration. Of course, they are not watch designers. So we have to, let's say, to translate their inspiration into a concrete watch, a product that we can then manufacture and produce. So this is our job to, let's say, to start from their interpretation of what is a trend in their view of a watch and then make it a concrete product. This
so
is the
let's
first
go
time.
Back to the question, why would they not want to do this themselves? There's a lot of very, very good reasons, but I don't think that your average person out there would understand why these companies are oftentimes in a better position. You're providing a service for something that these companies, for the most part, can't even do themselves. Talk a little bit about why it's even necessary to work with a specialist to make watches, given the fact that these are very powerful companies unto themselves.
Yeah, it is true that that most of the brands we deal with are very powerful. And indeed, if you look into the market, there is a clear differentiation between important brands that do the watches by themselves, and brands that apply to a specialist, an external partner. Indeed, it's not only a question of the watches, because you can also compare to other product categories, such as sunglasses, for example, for which I would say 90% of the brands, they apply to external manufacturer, because there is a specific competence, like in watches, for example. Because right. I repeat, you can have inspiration, but then design a product that can be manufactured is completely different, because there is technical knowledge that does not exist in a fashion house. Second, there is a question of distribution. It depends whether you want to have, let's say, an exclusive distribution in your own boutiques, or you want to have an extensive distribution, let's say, even in the, let's say, the watch distributor. So in the watch retailers, and not necessarily only in your monobrand boutique, which is also a point of differentiation, because if you just want to sell in your own boutique, well, you can do much more internally. But if you want to have, let's say, a wider distribution, then definitely you need an expert partner to do that. And
well, who are the companies that only want to sell inside their stores?
Well, for example, I mean, Chanel and Dior and Fendi are example not of exclusive distribution in their boutique, but primary distribution in their own boutiques.
Right.
And the trend is changing. Even if you look at Gucci, which used to be a very wide distributed product, now it's becoming more and more concentrated on their own boutiques. So it also depends, for example, on the number of the boutiques you can count on, and how deep you want to penetrate the watch market in your own boutiques, how much this is just a status symbol for your own customers, or how much you want to address to aspirational customers who wants to exploit the brand from different angles. And it's also a way, I would say, to expand the knowledge of a brand, because I would say that we have a complete different reach of end consumer compared to a monobrand boutique.
One of the things I've noticed, and I'd love your comment on it, is this fact. You'll take a brand which is a luxury fashion brand, and the pricing, you know, could be high. But then when you say, what's the pricing of the watches that go with your brand, you never could guess what the pricing is. The prices of the watches could be, you know, entry level to super, super high end. How do these brands make a decision when it comes to where they want to price their watches at? Because it seems to be sort of not random, but each of them seems to choose a different strategy. And I've always been curious as to how they make those decisions.
Well, indeed, first of all, in my opinion, it also depends on the moment when they decided to start the watch operation and what is the background. Some of the company, for example, used to run the watch business under license, and then they decide to internalize, so which has made a difference. Second, when we created this luxury division in Switzerland back in 2005, the market was completely different from what it has been in the past
six years. Completely different.
Completely different. And I can tell you, in 2008, 2009, I was selling watches with tourbillon movement for 150,000 euro under these fashion brands. Today, even to reach the 5,000 or 6,000 euro retail price, it's relatively difficult for the same brand. So it's not only a question of how prestigious is the brand, but it's how the end consumer looks at this type of product. So people have been more and more conscious about spending money. So they appreciate to buy fashion brands for a certain price point. And still, there is huge differentiation, because there are fashion brands that are absolutely luxury, but then they only have China-made products. And most likely, they did it just because they were or as you can imagine, selling more and then getting more revenues despite the positioning. You know that in the fashion business, a lot of brands, they used to run different labels. So they have the main label, second line, third line, fourth line, et cetera, et cetera. So right. A lot of brands have decided to enter the watch business under different level and positioning. What is for sure that when you start from the lower level, it will be very tough to, let's say, to elevate your positioning. So I would say that definitely Versace, since the very beginning, they decided to stay on the Swiss-made portion of the business. And we have maintained that position throughout all the years, despite as I repeat, very high important variances in terms of acceptance by the end consumers for fashion watches.
I've seen some of the brands do a fantastic job of incorporating their watches into their branding, into their runway shows, you know, onto their main website and marketing, and others that seem to want someone else to talk about their watches and things like that. Why is there such a difference there, and how important is it that the entire brand embrace the fact that they also make watches versus just treating it like another category?
Well, a lot depends on the designers. So the more that they say the designer of a Maison likes the product, the more easy we see the product on the fashion show, on the web, on the e-commerce, et cetera, et cetera. The less there is an understanding between the Maison designer and the product, the more the product will be treated in a separate way. So I have to say that, for example, with Donatella Versace, we have gone through, again, different moments. And recently, I would say in the past 2 or 3 years, we have seen an increasing interest of Donatella for the categories and passion for that. She's really wearing the watches with design, et cetera. So it's always a question to find the right balance. Sometimes you do fantastic watches, but then the designer might not say, oh, okay, I understand this is a product for our brand, but not for me. And you know, if a designer doesn't feel that something is perfect, he will not put in the fashion show. Fashion show is just 15 minutes show for the press, for the end consumer, and not necessarily is the place where you see product that then will be sold.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And it sounds like there's a lot of, I'll just say, personality, maybe egos, sometimes moodiness.
There must be egos. Absolutely.
There must be egos. Explain that. Absolutely. Sounds like it's a rule.
It's a rule. It's a rule in our world.
And you know, the ego is given a bad rap. So defend the egos. Tell everyone why, even though there's some bad sides, having an ego in the fashion space is crucial. I'm interested in this.
No, it's crucial because you need to have a strong ego to have a strong personality to succeed. Otherwise, I mean, at the end, you become one-off. And you need to be very distinctive in this world.
And what do you think your team is particularly good at? I've seen a lot of your watches, and I have to say, some of them are very impressive given that a third-party team is designing for the brand, the Ferragamo watches over the years. Just some incredible stuff. Versace, the creativity, going back to sort of the textures and the fabrics that the brand is known for. I thought you've done a sort of very, very good job. But in your words, what do you think that your team does particularly good, especially given that there are competitors out there that are also trying to get the license relationships?
Well, first of all, yes, there are competitors. But I would say to be comparable with our company, there are not so many competitors, okay?
Yeah, only a handful, it's true.
And there are maybe three, and maybe only two. And the third one, it doesn't look to be very much interested to enter the fashion world. They used to have one license, they abandoned the license. So maybe you have two competitors. Both of these two competitors are U.S. companies, as we are. But we have the peculiarity to have our luxury division set up in Switzerland, which may give us a very strong access to the Italian fashion brands. And you might guess that we are stronger with Italian brands rather than with US brands, for example. Because when you are close, you have the same mentality, you have a better understanding, you have easy access. You can imagine, I know brands, Italian brands that had license with the US companies. And to do a meeting, they have to calculate 6-hour difference. They have to speak English language only. You can imagine how much easier it is for us that we are in the same time zone. We speak the same language.
And let's be honest here. You would not be able to work with Italian companies if you weren't Italian. I mean, this is a necessary thing. This is by design to have the relationship with this number of massive Italian fashion houses. The Timex team must be basically primarily local.
It is not a necessity, but certainly it is a strong addition.
I see necessity in a good way because you're doing the right thing. You're doing what should be done. You know, in the U.S. so often, there's this common theme where they say this person who studied, luxury in France comes to the U.S. and tells them how to do luxury in the USA as though they know better. And I think that you avoid this problem because you're like-minded. You're able to get more done because you probably agree more often. This is a positive thing. And strategically, I think it's great for Timex because, you know, the world often thinks of, you know, French luxury as being the sort of epicenter, but there's just as many luxury brands from Italy. And so this strategy of working on the Italian ones, I think, makes so much sense, especially since the Italian and, of course, now Spanish fashion houses probably more prolific than the French ones. If maybe you'll disagree or agree, I don't know.
No, but for sure, let's say it is a strong addition that we offer to these brands. Even though I repeat that there are Italian fashion brands that are working with U.S. companies or whatever. Regarding to the French brands, a lot of them they stayed on a different position, internalizing the production, being part of larger group where you can afford even creating internal team for different brands. So when you see about talking Versace or Ferragamo or Missoni, I mean these are still I would say independent brands, even though Versace made part of an acquisition in the past couple of years. So independent brands could never really afford to set up their own watch operation. If you talk about French brand, there are two main groups. We get a lot of brand, not necessarily French brand, but now becoming French for the ownership. And then, of course, when you get so many brands, it is easier to set up also an internal, let's say, company or group of company also for the watch industry or sunglasses as an example of this French group.
Well, what's amazing is that even though you are third-party manufacturing, your products still are typically less expensive than the companies that internalize it. So the consumer doesn't necessarily win with all that internalization, do they?
Yes and no. For sure, the fashion world has been, I would say, built over the years with incredible profit margins. So the profitability of the houses, of the fashion houses, is very high, nothing to compare with the watches. But at the same time, I had many years experience in the consumer electronics. And if I look backwards, in the watch industry, we have very high margin compared to luxury consumer goods. So again, there is a lot of space for future evolution of things. And it's really difficult to predict which is the correct way. You have to, as I say at the very beginning, be very careful, constantly look at the consumer habits, the consumer changes, and be ready for the next few months or years.
How do you study what the consumer is doing? I think what you said about watching consumer habits is, of course, fantastic advice and sage wisdom. But how do you yourself keep up to date? Do you look at reports? Do you yourself, you know, spend time as a consumer? What do you do to study what's going on with the market?
Well, first of all, likely we have, let's say, a very wide distribution. So we serve more than 50 countries all around the world. And the first, let's say, signal that we receive is the sell-through of our product in different countries. So as soon as we introduce a new product, we have a very close control of the sell-through in all the various countries. So we have an immediate feedback. Second, because we work with this important Maison, they have a strong owned retail network, which is, again, a very strong signal that we have got a lot of feedback on the consumer perception and consumer reaction.
So you have all kinds of data available to you from the brands.
We have tons of data available. And last but not least, you know that today, let's say, the e-commerce is becoming more and more relevant. Not that it will replace the traditional distribution, but it's becoming very significant. And again, from the, let's say, the e-commerce, you get tons of information. And what is, let's say, very important to notice, in the e-commerce channel, very frequently, you get completely different information, or if you want to read it a different way, completely different sales compared to the traditional distribution. For one important reason, that you do not have filters. You go straight to the end consumer. While in the traditional distribution, you have a filter, which is your distribution. So once you enter in a shop, you always have a filter. In a watch shop, they normally run, I don't know, 20 brands. So you don't know what the sales staff will really tell to the end consumer. It's a huge filter. In the e-commerce, you don't have filter. You tell your story. That's it.
That's interesting. And, you know, what comes to mind is this, what you said before, how the brands have these different levels of products. And it may be the case that there's one type of product that is meant for direct-to-consumer distribution. There's another type of product that is meant to go in third-party retail. There's another type of product that's meant to go in the brand's own stores. Is that a possible future?
No, this is not the future. This is the present. Already today, we have, let's say, a channel product strategy. So each channel has a different type of product, and not necessarily the same product is working well in all channels. So there is a strong segmentation of product by channels and as well as by countries, because do not forget, for example, the size of the watches is very much different in Europe compared to Middle East, Americas, or Asia. So there is, of course, a strong product channel country segmentation. But what is really relevant is not only the product channel segmentation, but is really the fact that you speak directly to the end consumer. We have seen products that have not been very successful in the traditional distribution booming through the e-commerce channels. There would be no reason for that, except the fact that the e-commerce has a different approach. They try, they test. If it is successful, they expand.
Give me some concrete examples. I think this is absolutely fascinating. What are some things that, you know, worked in direct to consumer that just didn't work in retail? I'm fascinated.
A very simple example. I can mention one country, Germany, which has always been very tough for us. Very tough. We opened up a couple of e-commerce accounts, and the past 2 years, 2020 and 21. We are definitely booming in Germany. And there is no reason for that except the fact that we could access directly to the end consumer. So without the filter of the retailers, that maybe they didn't like the product, they didn't like the brand name or whatever. But then we see that the end consumer likes it. So
now there's always been this interesting difference between the luxury watch world and the fashion watch world. And there are luxury fashion watches, but not all fashion watches are luxury. And one of the unfortunate side effects has been that a lot of watch collectors, not including me, have maybe not taken some of the fashion watch brands as seriously as they should for silly prejudices. Some of them, it's as simple as, oh, that's a brand that makes products for women and I'm a man, so I want a man's brand. Again, sometimes silly stuff, but do you ever sort of feel that luxury fashion watches are sometimes treated unfairly because watch collectors might be kind of snobby, just saying it like that?
Well, first of all, collectors, they collect always in two different ways. The first, the easier way, it's what they like. So I cannot complain if those type of people, they're not collecting fashion brands. The second way is to collect product that they know will get value over the years. So they collect, but within brackets in terms of investment. They know they buy today, they can resell tomorrow for a much higher price. I don't believe
that's investing, like you said. That's not collecting. You know, you do it for a different reason. I don't believe that's what a lover of brands and products does.
Yeah, but if you see a lot of, let's say, the most expensive watches are collected by people who do it for investments.
Unfortunately, in my opinion, made those watches the most expensive. I believe that the collectors, I'm sorry to get off on a tangent here, but I feel passionately about this. These people who are speculators, all they're doing is driving up products for the same type of people who would have spent less money on them. Nobody wins except the dealers, and the only people that lose are collectors like you and me. I'm guessing you're a collector. So you know what I mean?
That's absolutely my point. When you recently see quotation for certain watches, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Products that are sold 10 times the retail price. I mean,
Yeah, I know some people get excited about it, but it's actually quite bad, you know, for the market. And it's
absolutely.
I'm glad that people agree with me on this, because sometimes I think that, you know, some of these auction houses are pretty guilty, but no one is calling them out. And the funny thing that people don't necessarily understand is that this is a conservative, polite industry. When there's something bad going on or something controversial, there's no immediate mechanism for the industry to deal with it, right?
Well, no immediate, but some of the brands are dealing with it. I mean, I know that today, if you buy a watch just to be resold, certain type of watches, and then it is found out, you will no longer be allowed, you as a person, but also the retailers, to trade those brands. So, no, there is a tentative. It's not strong, but there is a tentative. And by the way, we see the same all over the world. I mean, look at the car industry. There are people which buy the Ferrari because they like it and they collect. There are people who buy Ferrari just because they know they can resell for higher prices 5 years later. So,
and everyone that likes a Ferrari hates the man or the woman that buys it because it goes up in value. They hate that.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Same as we hate those people who gamble with their watches, but...
there's that too. I want to change the topic again because I'm actually quite curious what your experience has been like during the pandemic, especially the late pandemic. There's been supply chain issues, and that's affected so many different companies. How has your team been affected potentially by the inability to get parts, to make parts, and to do manufacturing as you need?
Well, I have to say that during the pandemic, we have observed a lot of other watch companies being seriously affected on the supply chain. And I have to mention that even for the Timex Group, we have faced, of course, some issues. I mean, we are not different from others. As the luxury division, and sometimes I'm honest to say, I don't even know why we have not at all been affected. Just consider that during 2020, we had a small decline, but in the range of few points, single digit, where most of the company were dropping double digit.
Not bad. That's congratulations.
And this year, I mean, our growth is 40% above 2019 in terms of volumes, which means that in terms of supply chain, we have been capable, I mean, to correctly plan, forecast, or use of components in a correct way that has not at all affected us. I mean, and believe me, we have, let's say, registering incredible growth this year and expected to continue next year. And my supply chain manager has not raised one single concern about, oh, Paolo, you know, this will have a problem. Some delays, yes, I have to tell you. I mean, normally we are very good in forecasting, planning, manufacturing. So once we receive an order, we know since the order which will be the delivery date and this year, of course. But at the end was a few weeks delays, which, I mean, I think was an amazing result.
Have you visited the gift store for watch lovers? It's called the Blog to Watch Store, and we carry art, apparel, and accessories for today's timepiece enthusiasts. Buy your wristwatches elsewhere and celebrate the watch collecting hobby with high quality original products at the Blog to Watch Store. Right now, the Blog to Watch Store features a line of t-shirts inspired by iconic timepieces and designed by the collecting experts at the Blog to Watch. Made from 100% premium cotton, our soft fitted t-shirts are stylish, fun, and models like our iconic diver dial even have a glow-in-the-dark face. The Blog to Watch store carries bespoke yet affordable products, which the Blog to Watch editorial team wanted for themselves as the first customers. Visit the website to see what is available right now, and we ship internationally with new products coming all the time. Check it out by logging on to store.ablogtowatch.com. That's store.ablogtowatch.com.
One of the things I was really curious about were the designs that you may be, you know, the most proud of. I mean, you've made a lot of watches over the years for a lot of really incredible brands that a lot of people have enjoyed. But what are some of the ones that you're really proud of that you think not only made a lot of sense for the fashion house, but in the scheme of watches, maybe considered really masterpiece designs?
Well, this is a question that brings me to my memory another important aspect. As you know, in the, let's say, the traditional watch houses, normally they have been able over the years to create some masterpiece that lasts for, and I don't want to say hundreds of years, but 20, 40, 50, 100 years or whatever. If you take any brands, I mean, Patek or Rolex or whatever, they have their one or two or three masterpieces which drive their sales, and then they are collateral product, of course. But when you look at those brands, everybody would be hunting for those two or three or four pieces. In the, let's say, luxury fashion business, we have been trying to do something different. So to create not every season, because they are not just a seasonal product, but every two or three years to renew the collection, to introduce new product, to be up to trend of the fashion brands, which means that not specifically our target, our aim was to create some specific masterpiece. Nevertheless, both in Versace and in Ferragamo, we have they say been very successful with certain products that have become a kind of masterpiece that we cannot skip out of the collection. For example, if you take Ferragamo, the Gancino watch for lady,
yeah,
is a piece that we cannot skip. I mean, it represents a huge portion of our sales, is the best seller all over the world, is requested by all our partners, whether it is traditional retailers or e-commerce, and it's not something that we could avoid to have or to renew or to introduce, to extend in different variations. And the same has been, for example, for Versace. We had several pieces that have been very, very successful over the years, and that somehow, even though maybe the name has been changed, but this is more a question of, they say, presentation to the end consumer, but the basic design of the watch has remained the same for many years. So for sure, if I have to mention one product, I would call out the DV1 for Versace,
yeah,
which was the first watch I've been introducing into the market back in 2005 when I joined the company. So when we established this company and they joined the company, and we only had Versace as a brand, we introduced the DV1, which was the Ceramica watch, and was a huge success. And the price point were relatively high, because the starting price point was 4,000 euro retail, going up to 10, 15,000. So you cannot avoid to have the memory of this good timing.
What is it like to deal with the Versace family? Of course, today, Donatella, it's, you know, this is such a known personality. I've never met her. She seems like quite an interesting individual. What's it like dealing with her, especially now that she's seems to be a lot more interested in watches?
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, the relationship with her is more dealt by the designer, our chief designer, because they speak the same language. Nevertheless, we try to have regular meetings throughout the year, just to not only to establish the relationship, which is well established in so many years, but really to be up to date, because I repeat, this person are really, I mean, evolving constantly. And basically, the moment you finish a collection, which is perfect, ready to be launched into the market, when they look at the collection, oh, this is ugly, this is old, because they already are mindsetted to the new collection.
They move too fast.
They are definitely, for the watch industry, they move too fast. So it's very interesting to try to make them understand that there is a compromise between the speed of fashion and the relatively less fast speed of watch industry.
Are they ever interested in complications or other functions that watches can have? I think one of the things that defines fashion watches for me is they focus very much on the shape of the watch, but it's very little about what the watch does. Is there ever alternatives to that or exceptions?
I repeat, back in 2005, we were doing a lot of these complications, moon phase, tour, up to tourbillon. I mean, we were doing tourbillon for our both our brand, both for Ferragamo and for Versace. The world has dramatically changed after 2009. It was likely coming back in 16, 17, but then the pandemic has changed the world again.
Yes.
So I think that if we have 5-6 years of relatively stable, I would say stable market, not even growth, but stable market, there might be opportunities because the end consumer, at the end, when they see a certain stability, they move little by little, they move for more upgraded product, which might mean for ladies, for example, more diamond versions, and for men, of course, more complicated movement. But we need a period of stability where when we go to this turbulent moment, I mean, the end consumer, when he looks at our product, they want to stay on more, let's say, safe side in terms of price point.
That's very, very interesting. And that's also very insightful that a consumer has to have enough time to buy one product and then learn about watches and then buy the next one and work their way up to the more expensive, complicated ones. If they're not making disposable income for long enough, they can never have that journey. Or if the market is full of insecurity, they might stop buying watches and do something else with their money.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. To educate people that under, a luxury brand, you can have watches that are valued as a true watch. Because, you know, even though we cannot publish that too much, but the engine of the watches is likely to come out from few factories all over the world.
Yeah. So,
and it's the same as the car industry. You buy a very expensive sporty car, and then you find out that maybe Toyota is supplying
because
the engine.
It's just too specialized. And you don't know. That's the thing. The consumer doesn't actually want a watch movement made from a bunch of like nerds in the garage. It said, we can do it like the big guys. You want like testing, the right machines, the know-how, the focus on long-term reliability, not just will it work for a month, but will it work for years, you know? Like, you want that as a consumer, but for some reason, collectors are obsessed with, they made 10 of these movements ever. Like, it's not going to work, guaranteed.
No, I know because in Timex Group, we have run for a certain period, a brand called Vincent Berard,
right,
where we were manufacturing our own movements.
That was a very expensive one, right?
Oh, well, there were a collection of, it was called the Four Seasons, was just four pocket watches, a pocket, and it was almost 700 grams of gold, so not really a pocket watch, but
wow.
It was originated as the collection of four pocket watches, one for each season. And that was okay, but then when coming to normal watches, normal for the price point they had, as you mentioned, if you do not have volumes, it's difficult to guarantee the quality. I mean,
what's your favorite price point to work around? You work within a few different price points, but what do you feel is the sweet spot between a price that market can handle and enough budget to do something cool?
1,000 to 3,000 euro retail price.
1,000 to 3,000 euros.
Yeah, that's the core of our business. And where we are, I would say, very competitive, not in terms of price, but very competitive in terms of what we offer for the price we ask.
And what should a consumer expect at that price point? I'd love to hear from you a couple of things that anybody buying a watch between the 1,000 to 3,000 euro price point, you should demand that this feature or this quality or something is in the watch. What would you say?
No, first of all, the quality. Definitely the quality. And I will say that again, it's also a question of distribution. Traditional distribution is still targeting to the quality of the product. Quality means how it is finished, that it looks really well finished, but then quality in the sense that they don't get returns from the end consumer. So I can tell you that we have a return rate which is far below 1%. So, which
that's
is
impressive.
Close to,
that's very impressive.
Which is far below the standard of the industry.
Look, there have been brands that at points in their history have had return rates of like 70 or 80%.
Yeah, but it depends what you aim to. I mean, the more you do complicated things and I would say not standardized things, the more you get into troubles.
The sad thing is that the consumers never thank you for getting it right. Thank you, Timex Group, for making me a watch that hasn't fallen apart after 15 years. Thank you for making sure that the polish still looks good after 5 or 10 years. You never get to thank you for that, right? Like, all the things you do well seem to be...
Because complaints. you get is complaints, for sure.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the consumer in the luxury space... rarely says thank you, but feels very entitled to complain when there's even the smallest issue ever. Do you think that because someone is spending a lot of money in a product, they by default have a right to say any opinion they have, or do you think that they still need to be reasonable about it?
Well, I think that because once you pay for something, it's included in the price you pay, the appreciation. and if something goes wrong, you need to complain. It's correct to complain. I mean, any complaint I will get, it's an help to be better. I mean, and over 15 years, 16 years in the group, we have been facing troubles, of course, and we fixed the troubles. And likely most of the troubles were detected by our quality control, so not even by the end consumer, but... If a trouble goes to the end consumer, you have to solve it. And if people that don't complain and they stop buying you, it's much worse.
Yeah, that's. I mean, definitely the active sales on the market is the best feedback for sure. Next question. Right now, it seems that all the watches you make are for licensed partners, and that's fantastic. I mean, I'm just going to read some of the names here. Versace Versus, which is part of Versace, Salvatore Ferragamo, CT Scuderia, which is cool stuff, Missoni, of course, Timex, Nautica, Guess, GC, Ted Baker, Furla. These are all licensed partners. Why does the Timex Group Luxury Division not make any in-house luxury watches anymore? Is that a taboo subject, or is that something that makes sense in the market potentially?
Well, it makes sense. It's my personal dreams, but there are some constraints. First of all, we are set up to sell Swiss-made fashion luxury watches, which means that we know exactly how to do that, how to communicate that. We have set up a distribution which is perfect for that, so retailers that knows exactly how to do that, which means when I introduce a new fashion brand and my partners look at the product collection, I have an immediate feedback. They know from day one if it will work or not. And we also know from day one if it works.
And it's because the Ferragamo name is most important. The product comes second, Ferragamo name comes first?
No, absolutely not. It's a mix of things.
Okay.
So it's the brand name, it's the design, it's the price range, etc. When you go to a product where you put your own brand name, which is totally unknown, you enter a completely different world. You should look for a completely different distribution, not retailers who sell fashion watches, but retailers who sell traditional watches, which is not, let's say, basically the distribution that we own. So we should build it up, which means that maybe we have to set up a different sales structures, set up a different distribution point of sales and channels, and then last but not least, to have the correct product.
It's brand building is what you're talking about. And traditionally, yeah, corporations are not amazing at brand building. They buy mature brands and then they monetize them.
Yeah, and that's one point. The other point is opportunity into the market. I think that today with all the world looking at sustainability, there is a good moment for study or introducing a brand where you can really develop a brand on full sustainability.
Tell me about that. What? How would it be sustainable? I mean, this sounds a little bit like, you know, what you want to do with your dream. So talk about it.
You need to have something which is distinctive. And I do not believe that for your own brand, just design is enough distinctive. Or, we are not in the movement world, so not even creating a specific movement. So what you need to have a distinctive idea. I think that today there's a lot of attention to sustainability, to changing the world, to be more conscious, et cetera, et cetera. So, for example, if I would launch my own brand, I would not study at all the quartz movement. I only study automatic movement.
Okay.
Because you don't have the battery. You can use all recycled materials.
It's definitely long lasting. It's not disposable. It fits within ecological friendliness.
Exactly. And then you build the story. Because today what is important is storytelling. What is the story behind? Big brands, they have the story. They have 10, 20, 50, 100 year history. You learn something new, you need to build a story, and you need to be credible on that story. Distinctive and credible.
So you think the sustainability message is going to be so relevant to consumers for so long that it makes sense to potentially build a luxury watch brand around it?
It can be. And we have seen that whenever we have presented, in the collection of our brands, a specific product based on sustainability, it's true that most of the time we're maybe limited edition, but was sold out in minutes.
Let me ask you a question when it comes to sustainability, because these days we have marketing sustainability, which is applying the term, for sales purposes. And then there's actually wanted to make sure there's some type of, net positive. And I think a great example is a lot of these recycled products are actually, less efficient than making brand new plastic, for example, because it actually today uses more energy to recycle it first and, make it to a material again. And they say, well, if you do it enough, maybe we'll innovate. What is your personal feeling on this sort of, doing it because it actually has a positive impact and other companies from learn for it versus, from a marketing perspective, you can get away with saying basically whatever you want. It doesn't actually matter if it's helping at all. It's just promoting the idea of it is good enough. How important do you think these sort of things are?
No, I think that you need to find a way to do things that the end consumer, which is not in this respect, ignorant. So there is not a lot of knowledge by the end consumer. So you need to have a real story. If you look at the car industry today, everybody is moving to electric cars.
Right.
But what is the cost of producing the battery? The ecological cost of producing, and then tomorrow of changing the batteries in the car or destroying the batteries of a car. It's not pretty, and I don't think that the advantage you have today, because today most of the people who buy electric car from a consumer perspective is just to, between brackets, to save money more than to be eco-friendly. I bought this electric or dual engine car just because I go to the office and I only spend one euro or 50 kilometers instead of 5 or 10 as before, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not really to be eco-friendly. I think that if we start a project in the watch business, should be a real project and not just a show-off.
And in the watch space, it's true. In Switzerland especially, you have all these watch facilities that are, they don't really have emissions. They're, carbon neutral, as you would say. There's a lot, they don't take up too much space. There's a lot of greenery. They're clean. These are... before it was trendy to be eco-friendly, basically an eco-friendly kind of company, right?
Yeah, we have started, as a Timeless Group, we started several years ago to try to become more and more eco-friendly. In the U.S., in our headquarters in the U.S., most of the electricity is produced by solar panels, for example. We have a huge solar plant in our facility. We are trying to become plastic free. So, for example, no more plastic bottles in the offices. We serve the water in the machine, and people have to bring their their own glasses to take the water instead of using plastic. So there are a lot of things that we are doing internally. And we are studying since many years how really to produce a watch which is completely eco-friendly.
So what are the most sustainable or low impact watch case materials and things like that? I mean, we have metals and carbons and plastics and ceramics and all that. Which good material actually is not difficult when it comes to the manufacture of it, whatever, and is pretty environmentally friendly?
Well, I think it's still recycled steel.
Okay.
It's still, the solution. I mean, recycled plastic, there's a lot of rumors around, but as you say, it's not yet clear what is the cost behind it. Okay, it's recycled plastic, but then the cost to recycle it is still not the cost in terms of what you pay, but the environmental cost.
Is it because we're so
cost.
Far advanced with recycling steel, or steel just sort of melts at the right temperature and it's just easy to blend up again into an alloy? What is it about steel?
No, it's that is exactly what you were mentioning. I mean, you melt it again, so.
Okay, so it's just a great, and look, steel is probably the hero of the watch industry.
I would say gold would be the same, but then we might have to discuss about gold mining, where we find gold, if it is, you enter some more complication, but gold would be the perfect example. You can melt it down and recycle it very easily. I mean, we recycle a lot of gold in the world normally.
No, we do. And again, I just want to go back to steel, because a lot of your background is, you know, basically what you do is handle a lot of manufacturing. It is kind of the wonder material for watch cases, isn't it? I mean, it's all the properties that it has. It can be machined very well. It's very, very strong. It's inexpensive. You know, people are always trying to find the next big thing, but steel has really been it, hasn't it?
Well, we have made several, tests of different materials. But then at the end, you always come back to the stainless steel. Even the ceramic has been a great moment. And I used to work for Rado when I was in Swatch Group 30 years ago. So I know ceramic since many, many years as watch application, which is from certain angle a perfect material.
It's a close second.
Yeah, it will be becoming the close second if there is more respect for the material. I mean, when it was very successful in the year 2005, 6, and 7, there were too many people which were pretending to say, oh, this is a ceramic, which was, very bad ceramic quality, made in very bad factories. I mean, while the real ceramic was only the time manufacturing
in Japan.
You're
right, there was some terrible ceramic early on that was like cheap stuff. But, I mean, look, it seems to be that ceramic has not only endured, but it doesn't cost a huge amount to get really good, you know, baked zirconium dioxide.
Again, it's a question of numbers. If you have decent volumes, it doesn't cost that much.
So what types of other materials, you know, are necessary to have this ecologically friendly solution? You can't make the entire watch out of steel, right?
No, well, I mean, it depends. If it is a bracelet, you could.
I guess the dial, there's a lot of metal, right?
the dial is a lot of metal. The movement is a lot of metal. The problem then is the straps, for example. So in order to avoid, to use the leather. But in that respect, there is a lot of materials coming out, and we have made huge research. So we have really quite wide knowledge on the straps. But then you have all the rest. You have the packaging. Then you have the display to put in the shops. You have the way you treat, for example, expeditions. So it's a long process. It's not just the way you build the product.
Last question, and this is about smartwatches. And I know that smartwatches are probably a topic you love and hate at the same time. smartwatches have probably hit the fashion side of the watch market harder than most other sides of the watch market. The watches above $10,000 haven't really been affected by smartwatches, but, you know, a $300 watch is really going to be affected by smartwatches. Eventually, the fashion houses will be able to do what they used to do with traditional watches, also with smartwatches, and of course, your company will have a part in that. But how do you feel that smartwatches can can take advantage of some of the things that you learn, because an awful lot of them are very, very unsexy. And, you know, I think it's so great. I show a Versace watch or a Ferragamo watch, and I'm like, okay, this is an example of a design you want to wear. The smartwatch, as practical it is, oftentimes isn't. You know, and when are we going to see this intersection of design as well as sort of smartwatch technology? You know, give us a little bit of a roadmap.
Well, it is relatively difficult to predict. First of all, smartwatches are a different segment, are a new segment, if you want, in the watch industry, which has several distinctive traits. First of all, the technology. I mean, the technology on a smartwatch, so you can imagine, I mean, a pure watch company which is used to have its own movement and or to buy movement and use it for 20, 30, 40 years, to have to deal with technology where you need to change everything every 6 months. Second, the cost of that, which is huge continuous investment, which then require volumes on the sales side.
Right.
Third, the distribution. Distribution of smartwatches is not happening in the same channel where the distribution of watch, traditional watches is done, because there is technology behind, because you need people who know technology, who can explain technology. Already we have people in the shops with struggles to explain the difference between a quartz and automatic movement. You can imagine when they have to explain about a smartwatch.
Right.
Going down to your question, if I see and when I would see a conjunction between smartwatch and fashion brands, I have to say that some of our competitors, they did it. It was not a great success. The combination can exist only if in a partnership. So if you have a consumer electronic company which is dealing with smartwatches, would want to join the project on a fashion brand.
Like then, Apple and Hermes?
Well, Apple and Hermes has been, let me say, I don't want to call it ridiculous because they are two fantastic brands, but they just put the straps on.
You're right. It's one way of doing it. It's barely any Hermes. It's 99% Apple, 1% Hermes.
No. And you can say it's 99% Hermes because the bracelet is so nice compared to the original.
Honestly,
one or whatever.
The Apple Watch leather is very good. You're not getting much of an upgrade with the Hermes. I'm not, and that's just saying the Apple Watch one is very good.
Well, you should look at the Missoni straps and case cover for the Apple Watch.
Apple proudly says they use Italian leather. Just saying.
Yeah. No, but for example, in Missoni, we have developed straps and the case cover for the Apple Watch, which do strongly personalize. So you see a huge difference. But of course, Missoni is
brilliant.
A lot of color, et cetera, et cetera. So you can do that.
Remember when Ulysses Nardin came out with their own mobile phone called the Chairman?
Yeah.
So I remember having a meal with the CEO at the time. And I said to him, wouldn't it have been a much better idea to just make a really nice case for the iPhone rather than make your own phone? And he just looks at me. He's like, yeah, that probably would have been a much, much better idea.
That's what I'm telling you. I mean, what is important is to find a partnership where a consumer electronic company, can be Samsung, can be LG, whatever, develops the technology and you just take care of the design around.
And that's the thing you do. I've always tried to explain, because I'd done a lot of internal discussions with most of the major companies doing the electronic stuff. And I tried to explain to them, you know, you do you and let someone else make it actually look nice. Like, there are specialists out there that know how to make all the stuff around it. So you make the guts, and it's working a little bit, but not really enough. I find that Apple has done such a better job than a lot of the competition. You know, Google with Android Wear, you know, other than LVMH, I can't think of any important products that proudly have the Wear OS operating system. And it's an open platform, yet it so has not been able to galvanize the right type of companies.
If you, again, go back to the history of fashion brands, whether luxury or not luxury, what they do, most of the fashion brands, they buy an existing movement. We buy from Swiss suppliers, the movement. and we create the case, the bracelet, and the design and all the rest. I mean, the only way is to do the same with smartwatches.
And I think I think that's the right idea. I think that's the way to do it, because right now, even though your strap on your Apple Watch can be different, these products lack the distinctiveness that traditional watches have. And I do very strongly believe there'll be a big, big market for, we'll just call them smartwatch skins or armor or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, but do not forget, you will still be linked to supply of movement. So the engine will still be supplied from external parties, which can always drive the sales. Look at what Amazon, for example, is doing. I mean, it takes a brand that are specialized on certain products, start selling them, make them very successful, and then all of a sudden they introduce an unbranded similar product. And they have killed a lot of companies.
Huh? Yeah, it's not pretty. Finally, Paolo, and thank you so much for joining us on this very interesting episode. We talked about so many great things. What should people expect next, maybe from your team at the Timex Group Luxury Division? What are you excited about that might be, you know, reaching the news or reaching stores in the next couple of months?
Well, I think that we are, let's say, building up Versace in a very, very strong way. Sales result has been amazing over the past 24 months. And we see the trend continuing to 2022 with a lot of new different products. So that will be certainly a good point. And in 2022, we look to announce an acquisition of a new important fashion brand.
That's fantastic. Everyone, this has been my interview with Paolo Marai. He is the CEO of the Timex Group Luxury Division. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Superlative Podcast. Support the show by subscribing and rating it on your preferred podcast platform. For questions, comments, and ideas, please email the show at superlative@ablog2watch.com. For the latest in watch news, reviews, and culture, visit ablog2watch.com.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.